Side 6. Good Omens. The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch. By Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 191. Newt turned this over in his mind. Thus far in his life, he'd never had the urge to drink alcohol. But something told him there had to be a first time. "Do witches keep drink in the house?" he ventured. "Oh, yes." She smiled the sort of smile Agnes Nutter probably smiled when unpacking the contents of her lingerie drawer. "Green bubbly stuff with strange things squirming on the congealing surface. You should know that." "Fine. Got any ice?" It turned out to be gin. There was ice. Anathema, who had picked up witchcraft as she went along, disapproved of liquor in general, but approved of it in her specific case. "Did I tell you about the Tibetan coming out of a hole in the road?" Newt said, relaxing a bit. "Oh, I know about them," she said, shuffling the papers on the table. "The two of them came out of the front lawn yesterday. The poor things were quite bewildered, so I gave them a cup of tea, and then they borrowed a spade and went down again. I don't think they quite know what they're supposed to be doing." Newt felt slightly aggrieved. "How did you know they were Tibetan?" he said. "If it comes to that, how did you know? Did he go, when you hit him?" "Well, he looked Tibetan," said Newt. "Saffron robes, bald head, you know, Tibetan. One of mine spoke quite good English. It seems that one minute he was repairing radios in Lhasa, next minute he was in a tunnel. He doesn't know how he's going to get home." "If you'd sent him up the road, he could probably have got a lift on a flying saucer," said Newt gloomily. "Three aliens? One of them a little tin robot?" "They landed on your lawn, too, did they?" "It's about the only place they didn't land, according to the radio. They keep coming down all over the world, delivering a short, trite message of cosmic peace. And when people say, 'Yes, well,' they give them a blank look and take off again. Signs and portents, just like Agnes said." "You're going to tell me she predicted all this, too, I suppose?" Anathema leafed through a battered card index in front of her. "I kept meaning to put it all on computer," she said. "Word searches and so forth, you know. It'd make it a lot simpler. The prophecies are arranged in any old order, but there are clues, handwriting, and so." "She did it all in a card index?" said Newt. "No, a book. But I've, mislaid it. We've always had copies, of course."
"Lost it, eh?" said Newt, trying to inject some humor into the proceedings. "Bet she didn't foresee that."
Anathema glowered at him. If looks could kill, Newt would have been on a slab. Then she went on. "We've built up quite a concordance over the years, though, and my grandfather came up with a useful cross-referencing system. Ah, here we are." She pushed a sheet of paper in front of Newt. "Note, to separate the text from the notes, all annotations will be preceded by the word comment. End note. 3988. When men of Crocus come from the earth." Comment. Crocus equals saffron. Compare 2003. "And green man from the sky, yet cannot why." Comment. Aliens? Paratroops? "And Pluto's bars quit the lightning castles." Comment. Nuclear power stations,
see cuttings numbers 798 to 806. And sunken lands riseth. Comment, Atlantis, cuttings 812 to 819. And Leviathan runneth free. Comment, Leviathan equal whale. Compare 1981. And Brazil is vert. Comment, South America is green. Then three cometh together, and four arise, upon iron horses ride. I tell you, the end draweth nigh. Comment, three equals four. Railways, iron road. Compare 2675. I didn't get all of this one in advance, Anathema admitted. I filled it in after listening to the news. You must be incredibly good at crosswords in your family, said Newt. I think Agnes is getting a bit out of her depth here anyway. The bits about Leviathan and South America and threes and fours could mean anything. She sighed. The problem is newspapers. You never know if Agnes is referring to some tiny little incident that you might miss. Do you know how long it takes to go through every daily paper thoroughly every morning? 3 hours and 10 minutes, said Newt automatically. I expect we'll get a medal or something, said Adam optimistically, rescuing a man from a blazing wreck. It wasn't blazing, said Pepper. It wasn't even very wrecked when we put it back right side up. It could have been, Adam pointed out. I don't see why we shouldn't have a medal just because some old car doesn't know when to catch fire. They stood looking down at the hole. Anathema had called the police, who had put it down to subsidence and put some cones around it. It was dark and went down a long way. Could be good fun going to Tibet, said Brian. We could learn martial arts and stuff. I saw this old film where there's this valley in Tibet, and everyone there lives for hundreds of years. It's called Shangri-La. My aunt's bungalow's called Shangri-La, said Wensleydale. Adam snorted. Not very clever, naming a valley after some old bungalow, he said. Might as well call it Dunroman or the Laurels. Slot better than Shambles, anyway, said Wensleydale mildly. Shambala, corrected Adam. I expect it's the same place. Probably got both names, said Pepper with unusual diplomacy. Like our house. We changed the name from the Lodge to Norton View when we moved in. But we still get letters addressed to Theo C. Cupier, the Lodge. Perhaps they've named it Shambala now, but people still call it the Laurels. Adam flicked a pebble into the hole. He was becoming bored with Tibetans. What shall we do now? Said Pepper. They're dipping sheep over at Norton Bottom Farm. We could go and help. Adam threw a larger stone into the hole and waited for the thump. It didn't come. Dunno, he said distantly. I reckon we should do something about whales and forests and such like. Like what? Said Brian, who enjoyed the diversions available at a good sheep dipping. He began to empty his pockets of crisp packets and dropped them one by one into the hole. We could go into Tadfield this afternoon and not have a hamburger, said Pepper. If all four of us don't have one, that's millions of acres of rainforest they won't have to cut down. They'll be cutting them down anyway, said Wensleydale. It's grass materialism again, said Adam. Same with the whales. It's amazing the stuff that's going on. He stared at Dog. He was feeling very odd. The little mongrel, noticing the attention, balanced expectantly on its hind legs.
"It's people like you that's eating all the whales," said Adam severely. "I bet you've used up nearly a whole whale already."
Dog, one last tiny satanic spark of his soul, hating himself for it, put his head on one side and whined.
"It's gonna be a fine old world to grow up in," Adam said. "No whales, no air, and everyone paddling around because of the seas rising."
"Then the Atlantisans would be the only ones well off," said Pepper cheerfully.
"Huh?" said Adam, not really listening. Something was happening inside his head. It was aching. Thoughts were arriving there without him having to think them. Something was saying, "You can do something, Adam Young. You can make it all better. You can do anything you want." And what was saying this to him was him, part of him. Deep down, part of him that had been attached to him all these years and not really noticed, like a shadow. It was saying, "Yes, it's a rotten world. It could have been great, but now it's rotten and it's time to do something about it. That's what you're here for, to make it all better."
"Because they'd be able to go everywhere," Pepper went on, giving him a worried look. "The Atlantisans, I mean. Because I'm fed up with the old Atlantisans and Tibetans," snapped Adam.
They stared at him. They'd never seen him like this before.
"It's all very well for them," said Adam. "Everyone's going around using up all the whales and coal and oil and ozone and rainforest and that, and there'll be none left for us. We should be going to Mars and stuff, instead of sitting around in the dark and wet with the air spilling away."
This wasn't the old Adam the them knew. The them avoided one another's faces. With Adam in this mood, the world seemed a chillier place.
"Seems to me," said Brian pragmatically, "seems to me the best thing you could do about it is stop reading about it."
"It's like you said the other day," said Adam. "You grow up reading about pirates and cowboys and spacemen and stuff, and just when you think the world's all full of amazing things, they tell you it's really all dead whales and chopped down forest and nuclear waste hanging about for millions of years. It's not worth growing up for, if you ask my opinion."
The them exchanged glances. There was a shadow over the whole world. Storm clouds were building up in the north, the sunlight glowing yellow off them as though the sky had been painted by an enthusiastic amateur.
"Seems to me it ought to be rolled up and started all over again," said Adam.
That hadn't sounded like Adam's voice. A bitter wind blew through the summer woods. Adam looked at Dog, who tried to stand on his head. There was a distant mutter of thunder. He reached down and patted the dog absent-mindedly.
"Serve everyone right if all the nuclear bombs went off and it all started again, only properly organized," said Adam. "Sometimes I think that's what I'd like to happen, and then we could sort everything out."
The thunder growled again. Pepper shivered. This wasn't the normal them, Mobius bickering, which passed many a slow hour. There was a look in Adam's eye that his friend couldn't quite fathom. Not devilment, because that was more or less there all the time, but a sort of blank grayness that was far worse.
"Well, I don't know about we," Pepper tried. "To know about the we, because if there's all these bombs going off, We all get blown up. Speaking as a mother of unborn generations, I'm against it.
They looked at her curiously. She shrugged.
And then giant ants take over the world, said Wensleydale nervously. I saw this film. Or you go around with sawn-off shotguns, and everyone's got these cars with, you know, knives and guns stuck on.
I wouldn't allow any giant ants or anything like that, said Adam, brightening up horribly.
And you'd all be all right. I'd see to that. It'd be wicked, eh, to have all the world to ourselves? Wouldn't it? We could share it out. We could have amazing games. We could have war with real armies and stuff.
But there wouldn't be any people, said Pepper.
Oh, I could make us some people, said Adam airily. Good enough for armies, at any rate. We could all have a quarter of the world each. Like you, he pointed to Pepper, who recoiled as though Adam's finger were a white-hot poker, could have Russia, because it's red and you've got red hair, right? And Wensley can have America, and Brian can have Africa and Europe and...
Even in their state of mounting terror, the them gave this the consideration it deserved.
Huh-huh, stuttered Pepper,
as the rising wind whipped at her T-shirt.
I don't see why Wensley's got America, and all I've got is just Russia. Russia's boring.
You can have China and Japan and India, said Adam.
That means I've got just Africa and a lot of just boring little countries, said Brian,
negotiating even on the curl of the catastrophe curve.
I wouldn't mind Australia, he added.
Pepper nudged him and shook her head urgently.
Dog's going to have Australia, said Adam, his eyes glowing with the fires of creation, on account of him needing a lot of space to run about. And there's all those rabbits and kangaroos for him to chase, and...
The clouds spread forwards and sideways like ink poured into a bowl of clear water, moving across the sky faster than the wind.
But there won't be any rab... Wensleydale shrieked.
Adam wasn't listening, at least to any voices outside his own head.
It's all too much of a mess, he said. We should start again. Just save the ones we want and start again. That's the best way. It'd be doing the earth a favor when you come to think about it. It makes me angry, seeing the way those old loonies are messing it up.
It's memory, you see, said Anathema. It works backwards as well as forwards. Racial memory, I mean. Newt gave her a polite but blank look.
What I'm trying to say, she said patiently, is that Agnes didn't see the future. That's just a metaphor. She remembered it. Not very well, of course. And by the time it had been filtered through her own understanding, it's often a bit confused. We think she's best at remembering things that were going to happen to her descendants. But if you're going to places and doing things because of what she wrote, and what she wrote is her recollection of the places you went to and the things you did, said Newt, then...
I know. But there's, some evidence that that's how it works, said Anathema.
They looked at the map spread out between them. Beside them, the radio murmured. Newt was very aware that a woman was sitting next to him.
Be professional, he told himself. You're a soldier, aren't you?
Well, practically. Then act like a soldier. He thought hard for a fraction of a second.
Well, act like a respectable soldier on his best behavior, then.
He forced his attention back to the matter at hand.
Why lower Tadfield? Said Newt. I just got interested because of the weather. Optimal microclimate, they call it.
That means it's a small place with its own personal nice weather. He glanced at her notebooks. There was definitely something odd about the place, even if you ignored Tibetans and UFOs, which seemed to be infesting the whole world these days. The Tadfield area didn't only have the kind of weather you could set your calendar by, it was also remarkably resistant to change. No one seemed to build new houses there. The population didn't seem to move much. There seemed to be more woods and hedges than you'd normally expect these days. The only battery farm to open in the area had failed after a year or two, and been replaced by an old-fashioned pig farmer who let his pigs run loose in his apple orchards and sold the pork at premium prices. The two local schools seemed to soldier on in blissful immunity from the changing fashions of education. A motorway, which should have turned most of Lower Tadfield into little more than the Junction 18 Happy Porker rest area, changed course 5 miles away, detoured in a great semicircle, and continued on its way, oblivious to the little island of rural changelessness it had avoided. No one quite seemed to know why. One of the surveyors involved had a nervous breakdown, a second had become a monk, and a third had gone off to Bali to paint nude women. It was as if a large part of the 20th century had marked a few square miles out of bounds. Anathema pulled another card out of her index and flicked it across the table. Note: to separate the text from the notes, all annotations will be preceded by the word comment. End note. 2315. Some say it cometh in London town or New York. Comment. 4 years early, New Amsterdam till 1664. But they be wrong, for the place is Tadfield. Comment. Tadville, Norfolk. Tardsfield, Devon. Tadfield, Oxon. Strong in his power, he cometh like a knight in the fief. He divideth the world into four parts. He bringeth the storm. Comment. See Revelation chapter 6, verse 10. I had to go and look through a lot of county records, said Anathema. Why is this one 2315? It's earlier than the others. Agnes was a bit slapdash about timing. I don't think she always knew what went where. I told you, we've spent ages devising a sort of system for chaining them together. Newt looked at a few cards. For example, 1111. And the great hound shall come, and the two powers shall watch in vain. Comment. Is this something to do with Bismarck? A.F. Device, June 8, 1888. For it goeth where is its master, where they wot not. Comment. Question mark. And he shall name it, true to its nature, and hell shall flee it. Comment. Schleswig-Holstein? She's being unusually obtuse for Agnes, said Anathema. 3017. I see four riding, bringing the end, and the angels of hell ride with them. Comment. The apocalyptic horsemen. And three shall rise, and four together be four. And the dark angel shall own defeat, yet the man shall claim his own.
comment. The man equals Pan, the devil, the witch trials of Lancashire, Brewster, 1782. Question mark, question mark. I feel good Agnes had drunk well this night. Quincy Device, October 15th, 1789. I concur. We are all human, alas. Miss O. J. Device, January 5th, 1854.
Why nice and accurate? Said Newt.
Nice as in exact or precise, said Anathema, in the weary tones of one who'd explained this before. That's what it used to mean.
But look, said Newt.
He'd nearly convinced himself about the non-existence of the UFO, which was clearly a figment of his imagination. And the Tibetan could have been, well, he was working on it. But whatever it wasn't a Tibetan. But what he was more and more convinced of was that he was in a room with a very attractive woman who appeared actually to like him, or at least not to dislike him, which was a definite first for Newt. And admittedly, there seemed to be a lot of strange stuff going on. But if he really tried, poling the boat of common sense upstream against the raging current of the evidence, he could pretend it was all, well, weather balloons, or Venus, or mass hallucination. In short, whatever Newt was now thinking with, it wasn't his brain. But look, he said, the world isn't really going to end now, is it? I mean, just look around. It's not like there's any international tension, well, any more than there normally is. Why don't we leave this stuff for a while and just go and, oh, I don't know, maybe we could just go for a walk or something. I mean,
don't you understand? There's something here, something that affects the area, she said. It's twisted all the ley lines. It's protecting the area against anything that might change it. It's...
There it was again, the thought in her mind that she could not, was not allowed to grasp, like a dream upon waking. The windows rattled. Outside, a sprig of jasmine, driven by the wind, started to bang insistently on the glass.
But I can't get a fix on it, said Anathema, twisting her fingers together. I've tried everything.
Fix, said Newt. I've tried the pendulum. I've tried the theodolite. I'm psychic, you see. But it seems to move around. Newt was still in control of his own mind enough to do the proper translation. When most people said, I'm psychic, you see, they meant, I have an overactive but unoriginal imagination, wear black nail varnish, talk to my budgie. When Anathema said it, it sounded as though she was admitting to a hereditary disease which she'd much prefer not to have.
Armageddon moves around, said Newt.
Various prophecies say the Antichrist has to arise first, said Anathema.
Agnes says he. I can't spot him.
Or her, said Newt.
What?
Could be a her, said Newt. This is the 20th century, after all. Equal opportunities.
I don't think you're taking this entirely seriously, she said severely. Anyway, there isn't any evil here. That's what I don't understand. There's just love.
Sorry, said Newt. She gave him a helpless look.
It's hard to describe it, she said. Something or someone loves this place, loves every inch of it so powerfully that it shields and protects it. A deep, down, huge, fierce love. How can anything bad start here? How can the end of the world start in a place like this? This is the kind of town you'd want to raise your kids in. It's a kid's paradise.
She smiled weakly.
You should see the local kids. They're unreal. Right out of the boy's own paper. All scanty knees and brilliant and bullseyes.
She nearly had it. She could feel the shape of the thought. She was gaining on it.
What's this place? Said Newt.
What? Anathema screamed as her train of thought was derailed. Newt's finger tapped at the map.
Disused aerodrome, it says. Just here, look, west of Tadfield itself.
Anathema snorted.
Disused? Don't you believe it. Used to be a wartime fighter base. It's been Upper Tadfield Air Base for about 10 years or so. Before you say it, the answer's no. I hate everything about the bloody place. But the colonel's saner than you are by a long way. His wife does yoga, for God's sake.
Now, what was it she'd said before? The kids round here. She felt her mental feet slipping away from under her, and she fell back into the more personal thought waiting there to catch her.
It was okay, really. And the thing about spending the rest of your life with him was, he wouldn't be around long enough to get on your nerves.
The radio was talking about South American rainforests.
New ones.
It began to hail.
Bullets of ice shredded the leaves around them as Adam led them down into the quarry.
Dog slunk along with his tail between his legs, whining.
This wasn't right, he was thinking. Just when I was getting the hang of rats, just when I'd nearly sorted out that bloody German shepherd across the road, now he's going to end it all, and I'll be back with the old glowing eyes and chasing lost souls. What's the sense in that? They don't fight back. There's no taste to them.
Wensley, Dale, Brian, and Pepper were not thinking quite so coherently. All that they were aware of was that they could no more not follow Adam than fly. To try to resist the force marching them forward would simply result in multiply broken legs, and they'd still have to march.
Adam wasn't thinking at all. Something had opened in his mind and was aflame.
He sat them down on the crate.
We'll all be all right down here, he said.
Said Wensley Dale,
don't you think our mothers and fathers...
Don't you worry about them, said Adam loftily. I can make some new ones.
There won't be any of this being in bed by 9:30, either. You don't ever have to go to bed, ever, if you don't want to. Or tidy your room, or anything. You just leave it all to me, and it will be great.
He gave them a manic smile.
I've got some new friends coming, he confided. You'll like 'em.
But, Wensley Dale began,
you just think of all the amazing stuff afterwards, said Adam enthusiastically. You can fill up America with all new cowboys and Indians and policemen and gangsters and cartoons and spacemen and stuff. Won't that be fantastic?
Wensley Dale looked miserably at the other two. They were sharing a thought that none of them would be able to articulate very satisfactorily, even in normal times. Broadly, it was that there had once been real cowboys and gangsters, and that was great. And there would always be pretend cowboys and gangsters, and that was also great. But real pretend cowboys and gangsters that were alive and not alive and could be put back in their box when you were tired of them, this did not seem great at all. The whole point about gangsters and cowboys and aliens and pirates was that you could stop being them and go home.
But before all that, said Adam darkly,
We're really going to show 'em.
There was a tree in the plaza. It wasn't very big, and the leaves were yellow, and the light it got through the excitingly dramatic smoked glass was the wrong sort of light, and it was on more drugs than an Olympic athlete, and loudspeakers nested in the branches. But it was a tree, and if you half-closed your eyes and looked at it over the artificial waterfall, you could almost believe that you were looking at a sick tree through a fog of tears. Jaime Jimenez liked to have his lunch under it. The maintenance supervisor would shout at him if he found out, but Jaime had grown up on a farm, and it had been quite a good farm, and he had liked trees. He didn't want to have to come into the city, but what could you do? It wasn't a bad job, and the money was the kind of money his father hadn't dreamed of. His grandfather hadn't dreamed of any money at all. He hadn't even known what money was until he was 15. But there were times when you needed trees, and the shame of it, Jaime thought, was that his children were growing up thinking of trees as firewood, and his grandchildren would think of trees as history. But what could you do? Where there were trees, now there were big farms. Where there were small farms, now there were plazas. And where there were plazas, there were still plazas. And that's how it went. He hid his trolley behind the newspaper stand, sat down furtively, and opened his lunchbox. It was then that he became aware of the rustling and a movement of shadows across the floor. He looked around. The tree was moving. He watched it with interest. Jaime had never seen a tree growing before. The soil, which was nothing more than a scree of some sort of artificial chippings, was actually crawling as the roots moved around under the surface. Jaime saw a thin white shoot creep down the side of the raised garden area and prod blindly at the concrete of the floor. Without knowing why, without ever knowing why, he nudged it gently with his foot until it was close to the crack between the slabs. It found it and bored down. The branches were twisting into different shapes. Jaime heard the screech of traffic outside the building, but didn't pay it any attention. Someone was yelling something, but someone was always yelling in Jaime's vicinity, often at him. The questing root must have found the buried soil. It changed color and thickened, like a fire hose when the water is turned on. The artificial waterfall stopped running. Jaime visualized fractured pipes blocked with sucking fibers. Now he could see what was happening outside. The street surface was heaving like a sea. Saplings were pushing up between the cracks. Of course, he reasoned, they had sunlight. His tree didn't. All it had was the muted gray light that came through the dome four stories up. Dead light. But what could you do? You could do this. The elevators had stopped running because the power was off, but it was only four flights of stairs. Jaime carefully shut his lunchbox and padded back to his cart, where he selected his longest room. People were pouring out of the building, yelling. Jaime moved amiably against the flow, like a salmon going upstream. A white framework of girders, which the architect had presumably thought made a dynamic statement about something or other, held up the smoked glass dome. In fact, it was some sort of plastic, and it took Jaime, perched on a convenient strip of girder, all his strength and the full leverage of the broom's length to crack it. A couple more swings brought it down in lethal shards. The light poured in, lighting up the dust in the plaza, so that the air looked as though it was full of fireflies. Far below, the tree burst the walls of its brushed concrete prison and rose like an express train.
Imee had never realized that trees made a sound when they grew, and no one else had realized it either, because the sound is made over hundreds of years in waves 24 hours from peak to peak. Speed it up, and the sound a tree makes is vroom! Imee watched it come toward him like a green mushroom cloud. Steam was billowing out from around its roots. The girders never stood a chance. The remnant of the dome went up like a ping-pong ball on a water spray. It was the same over all the city, except that you couldn't see the city anymore. All you could see was the canopy of green. It stretched from horizon to horizon. Imee sat on his branch, clung to a liana, and laughed and laughed and laughed. Presently, it began to rain. The Kapamaki, a whaling research ship, was currently researching the question, how many whales can you catch in 1 week? Except that today, there weren't any whales. The crew stared at the screens, which, by the application of ingenious technology, could spot anything larger than a sardine and calculate its net value on the international oil market, and found them blank. The occasional fish that did show up was barreling through the water as if in a great hurry to get elsewhere. The captain drummed his fingers on the console. He was afraid that he might soon be conducting his own research project to find out what happened to a statistically small sample of whaler captains who came back without a factory ship full of research material. He wondered what they did to you. Maybe they locked you in a room with a harpoon gun and expected you to do the honorable thing. This was unreal. There ought to be something. The navigator punched up a chart and stared at it. Honorable sir, he said. What is it? Said the captain testily. We seem to have a miserable instrument failure. Seabed in this area should be 200 meters. What of it? I'm reading 15,000 meters, honorable sir, and still falling. That is foolish. There is no such depth. The captain glared at several million yen worth of cutting-edge technology and thumped it. The navigator gave a nervous smile. Ah, sir, he said, it is shallower already. Beneath the thunders of the upper deep, as Azrafael and Tennyson both knew, far, far beneath in the abyssal sea, the clachan sleepeth. And now it was waking up. Millions of tons of deep ocean ooze cascade off its flanks as it rises. See, said the navigator, 3,000 meters already. The Kraken doesn't have eyes. There has never been anything for it to look at. But as it billows up through the icy waters, it picks up the microwave noise of the sea, the sorrowing beeps and whistles of the whale song. Said the navigator, 1,000 meters? The Kraken is not amused. 500 meters? The factory ship rocks on the sudden swell. 100 meters? There is a tiny metal thing above it. The Kraken stirs. And 10 billion sushi dinners cry out for vengeance. The cottage windows burst inward. This wasn't a storm, it was war. Fragments of jasmine whirled across the room, mingled with the rain of file cards. Newt and Anathema clung to one another in the space between the overturned table and the wall. Go on, muttered Newt. Tell me Agnes predicted this.
She did say he bringeth the storm, said Anathema.
This is a bloody hurricane. Did she say what's supposed to happen next?
2,315 is cross-reference to 3,477, said Anathema.
You can remember details like that at a time like this?
Since you mention it,
yes,
she said. She held out a card.
Note. To separate the text from the notes,
All annotations will be preceded by the word comment. End note. 3477. Let the wheel of fate turn. Let hearts enjoin. There are other friars than mine. Comment. Some mysticism here, one fears. A.F. Device, October 17, 1889. When the wind bloweth the blossoms, reach out one to another, for the calm cometh when red and white and black and pale approach to peas is our profession. Comment. Peas/blossoms? OFD, 1929, September 4th. Revelations chapter 6 again, I presume. Dr. Thomas Device, 1835. Newt read it again. There was a sound outside like a sheet of corrugated iron pinwheeling across the garden, which was exactly what it was. Is this supposed to mean, he said slowly, that we're supposed to become an item? That Agnes, what a joker. Courting is always difficult when the one being courted has an elderly female relative in the house. They tend to mutter or cackle or bum cigarettes, or, in the worst cases, get out the family photograph album, an act of aggression in the sex war which ought to be banned by a Geneva Convention. It's much worse when the relative has been dead for 300 years. Newt had indeed been harboring certain thoughts about Anathema. Not just harboring them, in fact, but dry-docking them, refitting them, giving them a good coat of paint and scraping the barnacles off their bottom. But the idea of Agnes's second sight boring into the back of his neck sloshed over his libido like a bucketful of cold water. He had even been entertaining the idea of inviting her out for a meal, but he hated the idea of some Cromwellian witch sitting in her cottage 3 centuries earlier and watching him eat. He was in the mood in which people burned witches. His life was quite complicated enough without it being manipulated across the centuries by some crazed old woman. A thump in the grate sounded like part of the chimney stack coming down. And then he thought, my life isn't complicated at all. I can see it as clearly as Agnes might. It stretches all the way to early retirement. A whip round from the people in the office. A bright little neat flat somewhere. A neat little empty death. Except now, I'm going to die under the ruins of a cottage during what might just possibly be the end of the world. The recording angel won't have any trouble with me. My life must have been dittos on every page for years. I mean, what have I ever really done? I've never robbed a bank. I've never had a parking ticket. I've never eaten Thai food. Somewhere, another window caved in, with a merry tinkle of breaking glass. Anathema put her arms around him, with a sigh which really didn't sound disappointed at all. I've never been to America, or France, because Calais doesn't really count. I've never learned to play a musical instrument. The radio died as the power lines finally gave up. He buried his face in her hair. I've never... There was a pinging sound. Chadwell, who had been bringing the Army paybooks up to date, looked up in the middle of signing for Witchfinder Lance Corporal Smith. It took him a while to notice that the gleam of Newt's pin was no longer on the map. He got down from his stool, muttering under his breath, and searched around on the floor until he found it. He gave it another polish and put it back in Tadfield. He was just signing for Witchfinder Private Table, who got an extra tuppence a year hay allowance, when there was another ping. He retrieved the pin, glared at it suspiciously, and pushed it so hard into the map that the plaster behind it gave way. Then he went back to the ledgers. There was a ping. This time, the pin was several feet from the wall. Shadwell picked it up, examined its point, pushed it into the map, and watched it. After about 5 seconds, it shot past his ear. He scrabbled for it on the floor, replaced it on the map, and held it there. It moved under his hand. He leaned his weight on it. A tiny thread of smoke curled out of the map. Shadwell gave a whimper and sucked his fingers as the red-hot pin ricocheted off the opposite wall and smashed a window. It didn't want to be in Tadfield. 10 seconds later, Shadwell was rummaging through the WA's cash box, which yielded a handful of copper, a 10-shilling note, and a small counterfeit coin from the reign of James I. Regardless of personal safety, he rummaged in his own pockets. The results of the trawl, even with his pensioner's concessionary travel pass taken into consideration, were barely enough to get him out of the house, let alone to Tadfield. The only other people he knew who had money were Mr. Rajit and Madam Tracy. As far as the Rajits were concerned, the question of 7 weeks' rent would probably crop up in any financial discussion he instigated at this point. And as for Madam Tracy, who'd only be too willing to lend him a handful of used tenors,
"I'll be swaggered if I'll take the wages of sin for the painted Jezebel," he said,
which left no one else, save one, the Southern Pansy. They'd each been here just once, spending as little time as possible in the room, and, in Azrafael's case, trying not to touch any flat surface. The other one, the flash Southern bastard in the sunglasses, was, Shadwell suspected, not someone he ought to offend. In Shadwell's simple world, anyone in sunglasses who wasn't actually on a beach was probably a criminal. He suspected that Crowley was from the Mafia, or the Underworld, although he would have been surprised how right he nearly was. But the soft one in the camel hair coat was a different matter, and he'd risk trailing him back to his base once, and he could remember the way. He thought Azrafael was a Russian spy. He could ask him for money, threaten him a bit. It was terribly risky. Shadwell pulled himself together. Even now, young Newt might be suffering unimaginable tortures at the hands of the Daughters of Night. And he, Shadwell, had sent him.
"We cannot leave our people in there," he said,
and put on his thin overcoat and shapeless hat and went out into the street. The weather seemed to be blowing up a bit. Azrafael was dithering. He'd been dithering for some 12 hours. His nerves, he would have said, were all over the place. He walked around the shop, picking up bits of paper and dropping them again, fiddling with pens. He ought to tell Crowley. No, he didn't. He wanted to tell Crowley. He ought to tell Heaven. He was an angel, after all. You had to do the right thing. It was built in. You see a wild, you thwart. Crowley had put his finger on it right enough. He ought to have told Heaven right from the start. But he'd known him for thousands of years. They got along. They nearly understood one another. He sometimes suspected they had far more in common with one another than with their respective superiors. They both liked the world, for one thing, rather than viewing it simply as the board on which the cosmic game of chess was being played. Well, of course, that was it. That was the answer, staring him in the face. It'd be true to the spirit of his pact with Crowley if he tipped Heaven the wink, and then they could quietly do something about the child. Although nothing too bad, of course, because we were all God's creatures when you got down to it, even people like Crowley, and the Antichrist, and the world would be saved, and there wouldn't have to be all that Armageddon business, which would do nobody any good anyway, because everyone knew heaven would win in the end, and Crowley would be bound to understand. Yes, and then everything would be all right. There was a knock at the shop door, despite the closed sign. He ignored it. Getting in touch with heaven for two-way communications was far more difficult for Aziraphale than it is for humans, who don't expect an answer, and in nearly all cases would be rather surprised to get one. He pushed aside the paper-laden desk and rolled up the threadbare bookshop carpet. There was a small circle chalked on the floorboards underneath, surrounded by suitable passages from the Kabbalah. The angel lit 7 candles, which he placed ritually at certain points around the circle. Then he lit some incense, which was not necessary, but did make the place smell nice. And then he stood in the circle and said the words. Nothing happened. He said the words again. Eventually, a bright blue shaft of light shot down from the ceiling and filled the circle. A well-educated voice said, "Well?" "It's me, Aziraphale." "We know," said the voice. "I've got great news. I've located the Antichrist. I can give you his address and everything." There was a pause. The blue light flickered. "Well?" it said again. "But, do you see, you can stop it all happening. In the nick of time. You've only got a few hours. You can stop it all, and there needn't be the war, and everyone will be saved." He beamed madly into the light. "Yes?" said the voice. "Yes, he's in a place called Lower Tadfield, and the address..." "Well done," said the voice in flat, dead tones. "There doesn't have to be any of that business with one-third of the seas turning to blood or anything," said Aziraphale happily. When it came, the voice sounded slightly annoyed. "Why not?" it said. Aziraphale felt an icy pit opening under his enthusiasm and tried to pretend it wasn't happening. He plunged on. "Well, you can simply make sure that..." "We will win, Aziraphale." "Yes, but..." "The forces of darkness must be beaten. You seem to be under a misapprehension. The point is not to avoid the war. It is to win it. We have been waiting a long time, Aziraphale." Aziraphale felt the coldness envelop his mind. He opened his mouth to say, "Do you think perhaps it would be a good idea not to hold the war on Earth?" and changed his mind. "I see," he said grimly. There was a scraping near the door, and if Aziraphale had been looking in that direction, he would have seen a battered felt hat trying to peer over the fanlight. "This is not to say you have not performed well," said the voice. "You will receive a commendation. Well done." "Thank you," said Aziraphale. The bitterness in his voice would have soured milk. "I'd forgotten about ineffability, obviously." "We thought you had." "May I ask," said the angel, "to whom have I been speaking?" The voice said, "We are the Metatron." Note, the voice of God, but not the voice of God, an entity in its own right, rather like a presidential spokesman. End note. "Oh, yes, of course. Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you." Behind him, the letterbox tilted open, revealing a pair of eyes. "One other thing," said the voice. "You will, of course, be joining us, won't you?"
"Well, of course. It has been simply ages since I've held a flaming sword,"
Azrael began.
"Yes, we recall," said the voice. "You will have a lot of opportunity to relearn."
What sort of initiating event will precipitate the war?" said Azrael.
"We thought a multi-nation nuclear exchange would be a nice start."
"Oh, yes, very imaginative."
Azrael's voice was flat and hopeless.
"Good. We will expect you directly, then," said the voice.
Well, I'll just clear up a few business matters, shall I?"
said Azrael desperately.
"There hardly seems to be any necessity," said the Metatron.
Azrael drew himself up.
"I really feel that probity, not to say morality, demands that as a reputable businessman I should..."
"Yes, yes," said the Metatron a shade testily. "Point taken. We shall await you, then."
The light faded, but did not quite vanish. "They're leaving the line open," Azrael thought. "I'm not getting out of this one."
"Hello," he said softly. "Anyone still there?"
There was silence. Very carefully, he stepped over the circle and crept to the telephone. He opened his notebook and dialed another number. After four rings, it gave a little cough, followed by a pause, and then a voice which sounded so laid back you could put a carpet on it said,
"Hi, this is Anthony Crowley.
"Crowley,"
Azrael tried to hiss and shout at the same time.
"Listen, I haven't got much time.
Probably not in right now, or asleep, and busy, or something, but..."
"Shut up. Listen, it was in Tadfield. It's all in that book. You've got to stop."
"After the tone, and I'll get right back to you. Ciao."
"I want to talk to you now." "Stop making noises. It's in Tadfield. That was what I was sensing. You must go there and..."
He took the phone away from his mouth.
"Bugger," he said. It was the first time he'd sworn in more than 4,000 years.
"Hold on. The demon had another line, didn't he?"
"He was that kind of person."
Azrael fumbled in the book, nearly dropping it on the floor. They would be getting impatient soon. He found the other number. He dialed it. It was answered almost immediately, at the same time as the shop's bell tingled gently. Crowley's voice, getting louder as it neared the mouthpiece, said,
"Really mean it. Hello?"
"Crowley, it's me."
"Ng."
The voice was horribly noncommittal. Even in his present state, Azrael sensed trouble.
"Are you alone?"
he said cautiously.
"Nah. Got an old friend here."
"Listen. Away with ye, ye spawn of hell!"
Very slowly, Azrael turned around. Shadwell was trembling with excitement. He'd seen it all. He'd heard it all. He hadn't understood any of it, but he knew what people did with circles and candlesticks and incense. He knew that all right. He'd seen The Devil Rides Out 15 times. 16 times, if you included the time he'd been thrown out of the cinema for shouting his unflattering opinions of amateur witchfinder Christopher Lee. The buggers were using him. They'd been making fools out of the glorious traditions of the army.
"I'll have ye, ye evil bastard," he shouted, advancing like a moth-eaten avenging angel. "I ken what ye be about, coming up here and seducing women to do your evil will."
"I think perhaps you've got the wrong shop," said Azrael. "I'll call back later," he told the receiver, and hung up.
"I could see what you're about," snarled Shadwell.
There were flecks of foam around his mouth.
he was more angry than he could ever remember.
Things are not what they seem, Azrafail began, aware, even as he said it, that as conversational gambits went, it lacked a certain polish.
I bet they ain't, said Shadwell triumphantly.
No, I mean...
Without taking his eyes off the angel, Shadwell shuffled backwards and grabbed the shop door, slamming it hard so that the bell jangled.
Bell, he said.
He grabbed the nice and accurate prophecies and thumped it down heavily on the table.
Book,
he snarled. He fumbled in his pocket and produced his trusty Ronson.
Practically candle, he shouted, and began to advance.
In his path, the circle glowed with a faint blue light.
Said Azrafail, I think it might not be a very good idea to...
Shadwell wasn't listening.
By the powers invested in me by virtue of my officer witchfinder, he intoned, I charge ye to quit from this place.
You see, the circle...
And return henceforth to the place from which ye came, pausing not to...
It would really be unwise for a human to set foot in it without...
And deliver us from evil.
Keep out of the circle, you stupid man.
Never to come again to vex.
Yes, yes, but please keep out of...
Azrafail ran toward Shadwell, waving his hands urgently.
Returning nay more,
Shadwell finished. He pointed a vengeful, black-nailed finger. Azrafail looked down at his feet and swore for the second time in 5 minutes. He'd stepped into the circle.
Oh, fuck,
he said. There was a melodious twang, and the blue glow vanished. So did Azrafail. 30 seconds went by. Shadwell didn't move. Then, with a trembling left hand, he reached up and carefully lowered his right hand.
Hello?
He said.
Hello?
No one answered. Shadwell shivered. Then, with his hand held out in front of him like a gun that he didn't dare fire and didn't know how to unload, he stepped out into the street, letting the door slam behind him. It shook the floor. One of Azrafail's candles fell over, spilling burning wax across the old, dry wood. Crowley's London flat was the epitome of style. It was everything that a flat should be. Spacious, white, elegantly furnished, and with that designer unlived-in look that only comes from not being lived in. This is because Crowley did not live there. It was simply the place he went back to at the end of the day when he was in London. The beds were always made. The fridge was always stocked with gourmet food that never went off. That was why Crowley had a fridge, after all. And, for that matter, the fridge never needed to be defrosted or even plugged in. The lounge contained a huge television, a white leather sofa, a video and a laser disc player, an ansophone, 2 telephones. The ansophone line and the private line, a number so far undiscovered by the legions of telephone salesmen who persisted in trying to sell Crowley double glazing, which he already had, or life insurance, which he didn't need, and a square matte black sound system. The kind so exquisitely engineered that it just has the on-off switch and the volume control. The only sound equipment Crowley had overlooked was speakers. He'd forgotten about them. Not that it made any difference. The sound reproduction was quite perfect anyway. There was an unconnected fax machine with the intelligence of a computer and a computer with the intelligence of a retarded ant. Nevertheless, Crowley upgraded it every few months, because a sleek computer was the sort of thing Crowley felt that the sort of human he tried to be would have. This one was like a Porsche with a screen.
The manuals were still in their transparent wrapping. Note. Along with the standard computer warranty agreement, which said that if the machine, one, didn't work, two, didn't do what the expensive advertisements said, three, electrocuted the immediate neighborhood, four, and in fact failed entirely to be inside the expensive box when you opened it, this was expressly, absolutely, implicitly, and in no event, the fault or responsibility of the manufacturer. That the purchaser should consider himself lucky to be allowed to give his money to the manufacturer, and that any attempt to treat what had just been paid for as the purchaser's own property would result in the attentions of serious men with menacing briefcases and very thin watches. Crowley had been extremely impressed with the warranties offered by the computer industry, and had, in fact, sent a bundle below to the department that drew up the Immortal Soul agreements, with a yellow memo form attached just saying, "Learn, guys." End note. In fact, the only things in the flat Crowley devoted any personal attention to were the houseplants. They were huge and green and glorious, with shiny, healthy, lustrous leaves. This was because, once a week, Crowley went around the flat with a green plastic plant mister, spraying the leaves and talking to the plants. He had heard about talking to plants in the early 70s, on Radio 4, and thought it an excellent idea. Although talking is perhaps the wrong word for what Crowley did. What he did was put the fear of God into them. More precisely, the fear of Crowley. In addition to which, every couple of months, Crowley would pick out a plant that was growing too slowly, or succumbing to leaf wilt, or browning, or just didn't look quite as good as the others. And he would carry it around to all the other plants. "Say goodbye to your friend," he'd say to them. He just couldn't cut it. Then he would leave the flat with the offending plant, and return an hour or so later with a large empty flower pot, which he would leave somewhere conspicuously around the flat. The plants were the most luxurious, verdant, and beautiful in London. Also the most terrified. The lounge was lit by spotlights and white neon tubes, of the kind one casually props against a chair or a corner. The only wall decoration was a frame drawing, the cartoon for the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci's original sketch. Crowley had bought it from the artist one hot afternoon in Florence, and felt it was superior to the final painting. Note. Leonardo had felt so, too. "I got her bloody smile right in the roughs," he told Crowley, sipping cold wine in the lunchtime sun. "But it went all over the place when I painted it. Her husband had a few things to say about it when I delivered it, but like I tell him, Signor Del Giocondo, apart from you, who's going to see it?" "Anyway, explain this helicopter thing again, will you?" End note. Crowley had a bedroom and a kitchen, and an office, and a lounge, and a toilet. Each room forever clean and perfect. He had spent an uncomfortable time in each of these rooms, during the long wait for the end of the world. He had phoned his operatives in the Witchfinder Army again, to try to get news. But his contact, Sergeant Shadwell, had just gone out, and the dim-witted receptionist seemed unable to grasp that he was willing to talk to any of the others. "Mr. Pocifer is out too, love," she told him. "He went down to Tadfield this morning, on a mission." "I'll speak to anyone," Crowley had explained. "I'll tell Mr. Shadwell that," she had said, "when he gets back. Now, if you don't mind, it's one of my mornings, and I can't leave my gentleman like that for long, or he'll catch his death. And at two, I've got Mrs. Ormerod and Mr. Stroggy and young Julia coming over for a sitting, and there's the place to clean and all beforehand. But I'll give Mr. Shadwell your message." Crowley gave up.
He tried to read a novel, but couldn't concentrate. He tried to sort his CDs into alphabetical order, but gave up when he discovered they already were in alphabetical order, as was his bookcase and his collection of soul music. Note: he was very proud of his collection. It had taken him ages to put together. This was real soul music. James Brown wasn't in it. End note. Eventually, he settled down on the white leather sofa and gestured on the television. "Reports are coming in," said a worried newscaster. "Reports are, well, nobody seems to know what's going on. But reports available to us would seem to, indicate an increase in international tensions that would have undoubtedly been viewed as impossible this time last week when, everyone seemed to be getting on so nicely. This would seem at least partly due to the spate of unusual events which have occurred over the last few days. Off the coast of Japan..."
"Crowley!"
"Yes," admitted Crowley.
"What the hell is going on, Crowley? What exactly have you been doing?"
"How do you mean?" Crowley asked, although he already knew.
"The boy called Warlock. We have brought him to the fields of Megiddo. The dog is not with him. The child knows nothing of the Great War. He is not our master's son."
"Ah," said Crowley.
"Is that all you can say, Crowley? Our troops are assembled. The four beasts have begun to ride. But where are they riding to? Something has gone wrong, Crowley, and it is your responsibility, and in all probability, your fault. We trust you have a perfectly reasonable explanation for all this."
"Oh, yes," agreed Crowley readily. "Perfectly reasonable."
"Because you are going to have your chance to explain it all to us. You are going to have all the time there is to explain. And we will listen with great interest to everything you have to say. And your conversation and the circumstances that will accompany it will provide a source of entertainment and pleasure for all the damned of hell, Crowley. Because no matter how racked with torment, no matter what agonies the lowest of the damned are suffering, Crowley, you will have it worse."
With a gesture, Crowley turned the set off. The dull gray-green screen continued enunciating. The silence formed itself into words.
"Do not even think about trying to escape us, Crowley. There is no escape. Stay where you are. You will be collected."
Crowley went to the window and looked out. Something black and car-shaped was moving slowly down the street toward him. It was car-shaped enough to fool a casual observer. Crowley, who was observing very carefully, noticed that not only were the wheels not going round, but they weren't even attached to the car. It was slowing down as it passed each house. Crowley assumed that the car's passengers, neither of them would be driving, neither of them knew how, were peering out at the house numbers. He had a little time. Crowley went into the kitchen and got a plastic bucket from under the sink. Then he went back into the lounge. The infernal authorities had ceased communicating. Crowley turned the television to the wall, just in case. He walked over to the Mona Lisa. Crowley lifted the picture down from the wall, revealing a safe. It was not a wall safe. It had been bought from a company that specialized in servicing the nuclear industry. He unlocked it, revealing an inner door with a dial tumble lock. He spun the dial.
4004 was the code. Easy to remember. The year he had slithered onto this stupid, marvelous planet, back when it was gleaming and new. Inside the safe were a thermos flask, two heavy PVC gloves, of the kind that covered one's entire arms, and some tongs. Crowley paused. He eyed the flask nervously. There was a crash from downstairs. That had been the front door. He pulled on the gloves and gingerly took the flask, and the tongs, and the bucket. And, as an afterthought, he grabbed a plant mister from beside a luxuriant rubber plant and headed for his office, walking like a man carrying a thermos flask full of something that might cause, if he dropped it, or even thought about dropping it, the sort of explosion that impels graybeards to make statements like, "And where this crater is now, once stood the city of Washington," in SFB movies. He reached his office, nudged open the door with his shoulder. Then he bent his legs and slowly put things down on the floor. Bucket, tongs, plant mister, and finally, deliberately, the flask. A bead of sweat began to form on Crowley's forehead and trickled down into one eye. He flicked it away. Then, with care and deliberation, he used the tongs to unscrew the top of the flask. Carefully, carefully, that was it. A pounding on the stairs below him and a muffled scream. That would have been the little old lady on the floor below. He could not afford to rush. He gripped the flask with the tongs, and taking care not to spill the tiniest drop, he poured the contents into the plastic bucket. One false move was all it would take. There. Then he opened the office door about 6 inches and placed the bucket on top. He used the tongs to replace the top of the flask, then a crash from his outer hallway. Pulled off the PVC gloves, picked up the plant mister, and settled himself behind his desk. "Crawley," called a guttural voice. "Haster."
"He's through there," hissed another voice. "I can feel the slimy little creep."
"Liger." Haster and Liger. Now, as Crowley would be the first to protest, most demons weren't deep down evil. In the great cosmic game, they felt they occupied the same position as tax inspectors, doing an unpopular job, maybe, but essential to the overall operation of the whole thing. If it came to that, some angels weren't paragons of virtue. Crowley had met one or two who, when it came to righteously smiting the ungodly, smote a good deal harder than was strictly necessary. On the whole, everyone had a job to do, and just did it. And on the other hand, you got people like Liger and Haster, who took such a dark delight in unpleasantness, you might even have mistaken them for human. Crowley leaned back in his executive chair. He forced himself to relax, and failed appallingly. "In here, people," he called. "We want a word with you," said Liger, in a tone of voice intended to imply that word was synonymous with horrifically painful eternity, and the squat demon pushed open the office door. The bucket teetered, then fell neatly on Liger's head. "Drop a lump of sodium in water. Watch it flame and burn and spin around crazily, flaring and sputtering. This was like that, just nastier." The demon peeled and flared and flickered. Oily brown smoke oozed from it, and it screamed and it screamed and it screamed. Then it crumpled, folded in on itself, and what was left lay glistening on the burnt and blackened circle of carpet, looking like a handful of mashed slugs. "Hi," said Crowley to Haster, who had been walking behind Liger and had unfortunately not been so much as splashed. There are some things that are unthinkable. There are some depths that not even demons would believe other demons would stoop to. "Holy water,"
"You bastard," said Haster. "You complete bastard. He hadn't ever done nothing to you."
"Yet," corrected Crowley, who felt a little more comfortable. Now the odds were closer to even. Closer, but not yet even, not by a long shot. Haster was a Duke of Hell. Crowley wasn't even a local counselor.
"Your fate will be whispered by mothers in dark places to frighten their young," said Haster, and then felt that the language of hell wasn't up to the job. "You're going to get taken to the bloody cleaners, pal," he added.
Crowley raised the green plastic plant mister and sloshed it around threateningly. "Go away," he said. He heard the phone downstairs ringing 4 times, and then the answer phone caught it. He wondered vaguely who it was.
"You don't frighten me," said Haster.
He watched a drip of water leak from the nozzle and slide slowly down the side of the plastic container toward Crowley's hand.
"Do you know what this is?" asked Crowley. "This is a Sainsbury's plant mister, cheapest and most efficient plant mister in the world. It can squirt a fine spray of water into the air. Do I need to tell you what's in it? It can turn you into that." He pointed to the mess on the carpet. "Now, go away."
Then the drip on the side of the plant mister reached Crowley's curled fingers and stopped.
"You're bluffing," said Haster.
"Maybe I am," said Crowley, in a tone of voice which he hoped made it quite clear that bluffing was the last thing on his mind.
"And maybe I'm not. Do you feel lucky?"
Haster gestured, and the plastic bulb dissolved like rice paper, spilling water all over Crowley's desk and all over Crowley's suit.